Hello, today is the 15th of August, and my name is Linda Lenski, and I'm going to be interviewing Jane Rowe. This is the second of what we anticipate to be three interviews. Last time we talked with Jane, she was telling her story of growing up in Wisconsin and her various experiences in those years and her college years and meeting her husband. So the last time we left off, Jane had eloped with her husband. So this is, I guess, chapter two of her story. And here's Jane Rowe.
Hi, I think maybe it'll be chapters two through 10, I hope. I don't know, I'll talk fast. Well, I found myself suddenly in Wausau, Wisconsin, where Lloyd had taken a teaching job, teaching English and theater, because it paid the most, and it was in Wisconsin. Originally, we had planned to try to commute and found out in those days it was an 8-hour bus ride, and neither of us had a car. So that plus a very bad schedule and the fact that my mother threw Lloyd out of the house made an elopement essential. Not a popular thing with my parents, who my mother especially was concerned what everyone would think, which was that I was pregnant. So she took care to remind everyone that I traveled around Europe all summer and was not pregnant. But I don't think she felt very secure about it either. She could have been, however, because I was actually a virgin when I was married. I hadn't had sex with anybody of either sex, and that was more common in my day by far than it is now. It was kind of more expected. Even in the sorority, heavy petting was acceptable. Intercourse was not. I noticed people talked about it carefully. If someone was sleeping with her boyfriend, she was pretty cautious about it. It was still a taboo. Sounds old-fashioned now, doesn't it? And definitely no discussion of same-sex sex. Just not on the tables. And so off we go to Wausau after our brief one-night honeymoon in the Edgewater, which was a totally unsuccessful venture. Besides being on the elevator, sex didn't really enter into it, and it was difficult. The year in Wausau was difficult from the get-go because I had a lot of conflict. I really needed a job, and I needed a job in a library, but they had a small library. They had all the help they needed. I had no other apparent skills. I did eventually get a seasonal job in a men's clothing store, which was horrible. I don't like selling things I'm not interested in. I'm not interested in clothing, particularly men's clothing. And they really wanted me to wrap Christmas presents, and I was abysmal at that. I have a number of thumbs, and I kept getting my thumb caught in the bow, and the whole thing was a failure. So I was cast in the role of a traditional housewife in this very small apartment in an interesting old house which had been a lumber baron's mansion. Lloyd was two blocks away teaching school, came home for lunch, and of course dinner, and this was a house with one big room, which had been the old front room, I think probably a parlor. It had a very, very fancy satin-looking wallpaper. I don't know enough about wallpaper to just define it more, but it was made of some kind of cloth and very, very elegant. And the other room, which was meant to be bedroom, dining room, kitchen, was smaller and had equally elegant wallpaper, but no particular attribute as a combination room. It was very difficult to work with. The kitchen was actually built into a closet. In order to open the oven, I had to step out into the room. It was tiny beyond belief. The bathroom also was extremely modest. And that was what I occupied for the day, and I felt very claustrophobic. And it was a downtown neighborhood picked because it was near the high school, and therefore you didn't really have neighbors. You had everybody else was off to work, and a lot of people lived in rooms. The only neighbor we knew was across the hall, and he was an older high school social science teacher who was very shy and was terrified that I would see him in his bathrobe. We shared a refrigerator in the front lobby, this sort of big entry hall that these fancy old houses had, and he would just scurry away. The only picture I have of him is his retreating figure with skinny legs protruding from a terry cloth bathrobe and little carpet slippers and just scurrying madly like an animal away from the refrigerator because I was seeing him at the refrigerator. And that was most of our contact. It was not a warm engagement. And for the first time probably in my life, I had no close women friends, not for really a long time, because everybody was working, everybody of interest. Lloyd was one of 22 teachers hired that same year. The high school had just had any number of people quit, which we were to discover the reasons for that. And they all kind of focused on our house because we were so close to school. I was there to set up, and it was a natural party house. People actually deposited their bottles of liquor there. They knew that nobody was prepared to provide liquor for 21 other people, so I guess it made 23 with me, all the new teachers, a lot of them in the English department. And so we had this group descend on us many nights after school and practically every weekend that we were around. And that was my social life, and it was really a very alcoholic social life because they were having quite a struggle. Some of them were first-year teachers. Lloyd had 1 year's experience. That was probably tops. There was one very, very nice woman named Carol, as I recall, came from Manitowoc, and we had good communication before both of us would be too drunk to really communicate, and I enjoyed her, but she wasn't really available. And anyhow, I was married, and that turned out to be a real drag because nobody else was in this crowd. They were all mostly single women. And Lloyd was great with women, with his big brown eyes and his mellifluous voice and stuff. Women always just sort of fell at his feet, which I didn't mind because I'd done the same thing. Who was I to complain, you know? And I knew he didn't have much sexual interest in him because he didn't have really very much sexual interest in me. He was bisexual too, but he was more interested in men sexually. It's just that he didn't get along with men. He couldn't keep their company. And this whole thing, uncomfortable as it was, learning to be a housewife, not having great success in the partnership realm in terms of developing an affectional relationship, Lloyd was very don't touch me kind of person. He liked to sleep way over on his side of the bed. He liked to not have me pat him or touch him, and I'm very tactile, and it was horrible. And it remained horrible for the 20 years of our marriage, this no-touchy thing. Also, had a very brittle, arrogant-seeming armor, which I knew was armor for a lot of insecurity because I knew his whole background as a child living through dire poverty and a very shameful father who was a drunk and beat his mother up regularly and was easily the most unattractive man I've ever had close proximity with. He's just a dreadful man. And so I felt bad for Lloyd, and I felt sure that if I loved him enough that we could get rid of that brittle exterior armor. I was to find that that wasn't a job that either could be done or that I could do. I don't know which. I think it couldn't be done because he's not had an intimate relationship since that's been preserved. He just can't do it. But I thought I would get through that. So, we had all these intellectual pretensions left over. I had just 2 years in college. I wanted to go back at earliest opportunity and finish. So I read a lot. That was a redeeming feature of living in this small space. Was able to take two courses that were very exciting on WHA radio, which was the other thing that saved my life. It was wonderful. Francis Hole, who died not too long ago, the emeritus professor of soils, was on the radio. And it seems funny for a essentially history and English major to be excited about a course in soils, but if you knew Francis Hole, you'd know why. He played his fiddle he had a deep tone for clay and a higher tone for sand and everything in between, and his lectures were just a joy. And I think it was second semester, I lucked into Michael Petrovich, then just an instructor at the university. He was to become a very renowned scholar, but Michael was teaching a basic course in Russian intellectual history. I guess that's not so basic, come to think of it. It wasn't just straight Russian history, it was intellectual history. And that was absolutely marvelous and right down my alley and led me to reading all the Russian authors and Russian everything. And I got the poets, I got very excited about it. And I remember writing a fan letter to Michael Petrovich, and he was so thrilled he answered me because he was just an instructor, you know, and he loved hearing from this housewife in Wausau, Wisconsin. And I said the problem I had with him was that his course was at 11 o'clock, and it always led to me feeding my husband rather inferior lunches because I was always so hurried. And so he included an apology to my husband for my inferior lunches. Well, they probably were, because one of the things I had to do that year was learn to cook. I was the kind of person whose only experience with cooking may have been starting a hard-boiled egg and boiling the pot dry. I mean, I just literally could not successfully boil water. It was all too true. Happily, there was a cute little Ma and Pa grocery store, quaint and now outdated, around the corner. And Pa was a butcher, too, and he educated me in cuts of meat and some things about rather traditional herbs and things to use, but he was good. And his wife was also helpful about, you know, the simple acts of how long you bake a potato and what you do with pasta and that kind of thing. So they coached me. And Lloyd just stopped cooking. He had been a fairly successful cook, limited range of talents in it, but I mean of recipes, I should say. But he just stopped. I was in charge. And something in him and something lurking in me were still traditional 50s people. So I think of it as my Betty Crocker era.
Yeah.
I did actually wear high heels a lot. I did actually wear skirts and aprons. And it's just ludicrous knowing myself now and looking at myself now to picture this, but it went with the 50s. It was what you expected to do. And it horrified me. It absolutely horrified me because it felt as if, despite all my good intentions and all my intellectual achievements and pretensions, I was turning into my mother, which is the absolute last thing I wanted to do. And it was the only thing that I really did want to do that my mother did was cook successfully. She was a great cook, kind of hearty farm style, but everything, she could do wonderful things with a pot roast. She made great Cornish pasty. She cooked lunch. We went home for lunch every day when I was a kid because schools were set up that way. Moms were supposed to be at home. So in spite of myself, I emulated some of this stuff or fell into the role. And Lloyd believed that women did the washing, the ironing, the cooking, and he smoked and he didn't even empty his own ashtrays. Mm. And he literally stepped out of his underwear. I was gone. I went to Whitefish Bay for some family event and was gone for a week. And when I came back, there were 7 pairs of underwear briefs on the floor in the bathroom. He couldn't even be bothered to pick them up and put them in the laundry in a hamper. And the wash had to be done in a laundromat, and that was, you know, that take half a day. It was horrible. And he wouldn't wear synthetic shirts, which had started to come on the market then, but he felt they smelled wrong and looked wrong, and he wanted all Oxford cloth. So I spent just about a day of every week ironing, which I loathe. I absolutely loathe. I tried to get through it by doing things like, I was trying to learn Russian, and I would tack a sheet of Russian verbs on the ironing board and see, but it ended up either forgetting the verb or scorching the Oxford cloth or something. It was not a great success. So it was an extremely difficult year. And the highlight of it, however, was an absolutely marvelous production that Lloyd directed with the kids. I don't remember whether it was a senior class play. I think it was, but he did a modern dress, formals and tuxedos modern dress version of Romeo and Juliet that was just a wow. He worked with the kids so they really understood what they were saying. Romeo was a football hero. Juliet was the honor student of the senior class, probably the valedictorian. And they were a very interesting blend, but they were both terrific. And because the kids all knew what they were saying, and it wowed he had a really warm letter from the superintendent of schools, and people were just knocked flat by it. So it was a terrific success. And I was very proud of that. But it took them away every evening and made my days longer. They had endless rehearsals. And, of course, I was really totally left out of it. There wasn't much of a way to participate except to go to the play. But I was very proud of him and proud of it. It was an outstanding thing. But all of the teachers were unhappy. Wausau had no middle class at that time. I understand it's developed one since. But everybody was either rich and was a doctor or an insurance executive and lived up on the hill and kind of traditionally. And they went to lovely events in Minneapolis and flew to New York and things like that to have some culture. So there was no, like, local culture. There was not local theater or local anything that we were used to in Madison, except for the senior class play. And the other class was working class, and they played something, pinochle, sheep's head, I don't know what, in church basements. And they bowled. And this was not attractive to most of the teachers or to me. And so we just didn't have a place. They had a newcomers club, and they called up and invited us to newcomers club. And after a little bit, I said, how long have you lived in Wausau? And this guy said, 7 years. I said, you're still a newcomer after 7 years? And he said, well, that's the way it works here. And I said, I was afraid of that. So of the 22 teachers hired that year, 21 quit after 1 year, which sort of tells its own story. And all of the gang who used to drink at our house, which was most of the 22, got royally drunk, finished off their bottles that they had stashed there because we were all leaving Wausau. And we went downtown and shouted dreadful things about Wausau and leaped over the parking meters. I remember being nimble enough in those days to do that. We sort of vaulted over them, you know, and just kind of shook Wausau out of us. It was not a good good place for teachers to be. And I was just very unsettled by it, but Madison loomed. We decided to return to Madison. Lloyd got a teaching job at, no, we had a very poor summer. We lived in a tiny little place. We had very little money. I think we both worked part-time at the library where I had worked and sort of eked out. And I took one course, which was intensive German, and was it ever intensive? It was murder. It was like total immersion every day, but rather exciting. And we lived in a tiny apartment in a house on Langdon Street, which is now burned down. It's interesting to look at it. And but then Lloyd got a job teaching English at Central High, and I was by then well into my junior year and excited, and we loved Madison. And the thing I think that reigned through this period was that I was living part of my life, as I always have, in the books that I was reading. And a lot of the reading, especially after traveling to England and taking English literature course and doing some of those things my sophomore year, was kind of around the Bloomsbury era. And they suited me a lot. The intellectual stuff, the bisexuality that was expressed, the wit, the whole company of it. I sort of overlooked the fact that they were almost all rich and had a lot of options. And we were very, very poor. I mean, incredibly poor. We paid $60 a month rent, and it was very hard to get that together every month, very hard. And so, but this Bloomsbury feeling was there, and that's, we recaptured this Madison. And the fact that our personal relationship in terms of intimacy, in terms of real self-disclosure and stuff was very thin, very, very thin. We both developed other friendships, Lloyd with the staff at Central High, and I with people I took classes with, and we had a big thing eventually for international students. So we balanced our marriage outside of it, really. And but I didn't feel at that point any particular draw to women or to men, really. I think I was in my head much of the time. That was where it rested. And I got nice scholarships, which paid my tuition and helped our budget, and Lloyd was teaching. And at one point in 19, we had 3 years of this, at 1955, we were able to live on Lloyd's salary, and I got a really dandy fellowship, and we were able to save that money and go to Europe for the summer. And we planned to hitchhike. We had a very, very lean budget because the fellowship, you know, was good for those days, and the dollar was still very strong. But we went to England and hitchhiked all over and renewed my enthusiasm for everything from the way English houses smelled like my grandmother's to the whole Bloomsbury thing. And we had a marvelous time. It was still very post-war in England, so there weren't enough cars on the road. We mostly drove with commercial people. One time, a man who carried pigs in his van to market picked us up, and Lloyd had to stay back where the pigs had stayed, and he was not a happy camper. And I had planned for us to stay in youth hostels because of our budget, and Lloyd, we stayed in exactly one, and Lloyd said, the men's dorm smells like men's feet, and I can't stand it. So we broke our budget and stayed in B&Bs, which made us come home early, but it was a glorious experience. And I'm very glad that we got to do it. There was something about hitchhiking down the south coast of Cornwall, which is such an interesting place because of the Gulf Stream, and having everything we really cared about in rucksacks on our back, what we'd left behind in a sublet apartment, we sublet it to an Arab friend and went off, was meaningless to us. And we were complete right there, who we were, and life just opened before us. And it was one of those moments of pure bliss. I like where I am right now. And that was kind of amazing to me. Didn't picture what we had to do or where we'd been or anything. It just seemed complete right there. So that was pretty terrific. And one of our international friends in Madison had been an Englishman named Hugh Pepiot, who, unbeknownst to us really, turned out to be quite an upper-class Englishman. His uncle was what would be the equivalent of Secretary of the Treasury. And his father, my gosh, was in the House of Lords. We stayed in a rather run-down boarding house in a rather run-down part of London while we were in London. I think we stayed at Mrs. Blatch's for a week or two. And then we were going to go to Pepiot's elegant home, an estate out in Bucks. And Dad came to pick us up, and he turned out he'd been to some kind of do at the House of Lords. So he came to pick us up in his elegant car. God knows what it was. It was yards long. Rolls Royce, I think. and he was wearing tails and had all his medals on from whatever war, World War I, I suppose, and it was just unbelievable. And of course, the boarding house folks all were just gazing out the window in awe at this. It was so funny. And you could see him, he was almost dusting off his tails because he wasn't quite used to this part of London in this sort of circumstance. But he was very cordial, and his wife was wonderful, and we had a great visit in this elegant place. Huge house, and they had a staff of seven, and they had marvelous gardens, and they had what they lovingly called central heating, which was three small radiators located in very inconvenient places, like the front hall where you never were. The bedrooms were totally unheated. Even in the summer, it was cold and damp and awful, but it's just weird. That's the way the English are. But it was a great experience. And then Mrs. Pepiot had to drive us out at the end of, I think it was a week, and put us on the highway, and she was very dear and motherly, and she hugged us both and said, "Oh, I hope somebody nice picks you up." She put us out on the highway, and we got a ride right away with somebody nice, and off we went, and looked back at this motherly person waving, and you could see her trying to evaluate our driver. Was it going to be safe for us? And I think she worried her way through the rest of our summer. So we stayed in touch because she was so dear. She told me once, we got to be kind of good friends doing stuff together while we were in the house, and she said that the big regret of her life was that Hugh, the son, who was such a close friend of ours too, had been reared in the traditional English upper class way, and that he had had a nanny until he went off to boarding school, and then he was in boarding school and just home for vacations, and she'd never had a chance to really be his mother, and she loved him, and it was so hard. And she said, one time when he got sick, he cried for his nanny and not for me, and it broke my heart. And I felt so bad for her and for Hugh. I think it's still going on. There's a whole generation and still ongoing of British men and some women too who are motherless for that reason. Fortunately, there are a lot of good nannies, I guess, so they have some sort of figure in place, but it's not the same thing. And it was just very interesting. And it triggered something in me because something was growing in me about motherhood, and I think what it was Mother Nature and hormones. I was 23 years old when we went to Europe, and it was I was being interested in that whole thing. I was very interested in what Mrs. Pepiot told me, and we were talking in the abstract, Lloyd and I, about having a family. We both wanted a substantial family, and seemed to be prepared to have enough sex to produce them, and that's about all. I don't know, since that was not a driving force for either of us, sex with each other. And but we did both want children, and we both wanted to rear them differently than our parents had reared us, especially his parents, because that was an awful scene. Drunken Catholic mayhem was his family background, and mine felt stultifying, and I didn't want to do that either. So we were talking about those things. So then we get back to Madison, and we had to leave early because we ran out of money in Paris. We lived on day-old bread and tomatoes for a few days, and that palled. That was not a good thing. So a friend took us in because our apartment had two more weeks to go with the sublet, and we came back and stayed with a dear friend who was Lloyd's department chair at Central High. An interesting thing about her arrangement was that she co-owned a duplex out on the near west side, Palomino Lane. There were still Palomino horses in the pasture at that time. And her downstairs beloved roommates were a lesbian couple named Mobby and Peg, both librarians. Peg was a dynamo. She was head of the school library department in Madison, and it was like a model for the world. It was just great. Everybody was so proud of it, and Peg was a big, handsome woman. And Mobby was a retired librarian who had some money. She was the only child of fairly wealthy farmers, and she ran a business indexing children's magazines in her basement and in her dining room, and they were very, very congenial. They were the best model I had ever seen of two people living together in a close relationship where each seemed to be fulfilling her own potential. And that was my first introduction to lesbianism. And it was a marvelous one because it did look like such a good model. They had so much in common, but such distinct lives and personalities and fun. And they had very intergenerational connections. Peg had a nephew who had six kids, and the house had full equipment. They had high chairs and playpens and toys, and people of all ages were always streaming through their house, and it was just a great relationship. And ultimately, I ended up working for PEG, but that's later. So that was my introduction to lesbianism, and it really could not have been a more positive one. I would so much savor their being alive today and be still in our lives. Lloyd loved them too. They were just dear, dear, dear women. And so we got back from Europe, and I proceeded. I was starting on my master's degree by then, and well connected in the British History Department, and made a particularly good connection with the America's premier scholar of British Commonwealth history, which was sort of weird because he was a Norwegian who'd come over at 19, had a strong accent. Tall, gorgeous, handsome man. He looked like a judge. He had a shock of white hair and very strong features, and just a dear man. And he really took to me, liked me a lot. And we just got on swimmingly, and he was very pro-Commonwealth. He was a flat-out imperialist now by current standards, and I followed right in his wake. I thought it was neat that Britain was all over the world running everything because I was so pro-English, such an Anglophile. And Paul Daplin liked me so much that he assured me that I could have a Fulbright scholarship anywhere I wanted to go. And I said, what do I do about Lloyd? And he said, oh, you can pick up a job teaching. Probably that won't be a problem. You'll have enough to live on. And so we decided on New Zealand that would be a good place to go. And so he proceeded, and I was all lined up for a Fulbright scholarship New Zealand when I got my master's the next year. And then I skipped a period. And then I skipped another period, and sure enough, I was pregnant with our first child. Well, I don't know how it is now, but they were not welcoming in the Fulbright ranks to pregnant women in those days. So that was just dropped. Paul was disappointed, but he had kids and loved them, and his wife was very enthusiastic about me being pregnant. So we, even though it was an accident and untimely and all sorts of things, I had my master's orals in June, and I was so pregnant that I had a sense that they just wanted me out of that office before I gave birth. And the questions were very easy, and they got me through. And I think my major professor gave me a hug. Bill Saxey was my major professor, and he was just wonderful. Historians weren't too welcoming to women in their ranks in those days, except for Bill Saxey. And he had three of us for whom he was mentor in graduate school. And they used to sometimes call him Saxey's harem because he was such a nut, having three women. Ugh, it was such a sexist department. But he was a great guy and warm, and I loved his wife, too, and they were just neat people. And so I got my master's, and then a month later got Jock. He came 2 weeks early. And that just opened something in me, and in Lloyd, too. I had a kidney infection after birth, so he took full-time care of the baby for a couple of weeks while I was rehospitalized, and he got very bonded with Jock. And by then, he'd quit at Central High and was in graduate school, and our plan was to both, this is the ambition of youth, Linda, I tell you, we were both going to work part-time enough to live on, just, you know, voluntary poverty, both go to graduate school nearly full-time, and parent Jock, and try to work it so that we didn't have babysitters, so we were with Jock. And of course, you know, keep house and keep up washing diapers and blah, 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 all this stuff. And we did it, but we stumbled through a lot of it exhausted. But we were both very devoted and concerned parents. And I remember most vividly leaving my job. Oh, I had a full-time job at the library right after Jacques was born. And I would go at 6 in the morning, because they gave us flex time, work in the catalog department, take my noon hour at 9:30, because Lloyd had an English seminar, and he would come down Langdon Street with Jacques in his arms, and we didn't even own a stroller then, I don't believe, or Jacques wasn't old enough, and then I would take Jacques, he would pass him to me like a tenderly wrapped football, and I would carry him the rest of the way up Langdon Street, and change Jock and feed him and bathe him and wash diapers and blah, blah, blah. And then Lloyd would come back from his English seminar. Jock was usually asleep by then. He'd come all the way, and I'd go back to my job, and then I would work from 11:30 until 5:30, and it was awful. I remember looking at the clock. This was mostly working in the card catalog, doing extremely, excruciatingly boring things. And I would look at the clock, and it would be 2 o'clock, and then I'd think, oh, I better 2 more hours have passed, and I would look at the clock, and it would be 2:03. It was just horrible boredom. But we got through it, and we did it. And by the time Jacques was born, we had a somewhat larger apartment on Langdon Street. And Elizabeth Ritzman stayed on as a close friend, even though Lloyd had gone back to school and wasn't involved with her on a daily basis. And somewhere in there, Lloyd decided he wanted to be a psychiatrist and go to medical school. So that was fine. We could do that, too. We're still caught up in this kind of Bloomsbury intellectual thing. And I think sometime shortly thereafter, I don't know really when, I think Lloyd started having random affairs with men. I think mostly one-night stands, but more of a sexual out in that direction. I think his sexuality was then more directed to men, even though he was very much caught up in the whole marriage thing, and that was part of his presentation to the world and to himself, and he wanted to be a father, and all of those things he did. But it didn't bother me. We didn't have AIDS fears in those days, and I treated it just like I would if he'd suddenly got interested in electric trains or something. It was just one of those things boys do, you know, men do, that's a sort of a leftover from, I think a lot of English wives must be this way, because so many of homosexual experiences just as a part of growing up and continue to, and it's just kind of there. And I had that attitude. It really didn't bother me. Rarely did I meet these men, but once in a while I did, and they were pretty interesting folks. He had a longer-lasting affair, actually, with a colleague of mine in the British History Department, and that was kind of nice because he was like family. I liked him. And ultimately, Lloyd's best friend from college, a guy he'd worked with in the college radio station closely, name of Murray Page, came to get a degree in speech pathology, and he stayed not with us but in the same building and ate with us. So we had this kind of interesting family. Elizabeth ate with us a lot and had us to dinner at her place, and Murray was with us a lot. And I liked that. I liked the sense of the bigger family. I liked the exchange we had. I liked the warmth. Elizabeth was very physical, and I connected with her easily. We would sit through an evening holding hands. I mean, it's weird in retrospect, but we would. And she wasn't a lesbian, I mean, not acting out anyway, but she was very comfortable with female intimacy, because her best friends were two lesbians, and she just was, and she was a single woman and had never done anything I know of with either men or women, so it was just kind of an interesting time, and it fitted the Bloomsbury image, too. And ultimately, we got a bigger apartment, and just around the corner on Henry Street, if you stood on one leg and turned your head, you could see the lake. And Murray made it possible for us to rent it. It was a breathtaking rent. It was $90. And we moved in there, and at some point in there, I think the first year, or maybe before we even moved, I got pregnant deliberately with our next child. We wanted to expand our family. And it turned out to be our daughter, Michelle, who not only was the only planned child I had, but arrived on the day she was due, and has ever since been very precise and kind of perfectionist about what she does. She was just, and she was perfect. We thought Jacques was perfect too. So there we are in this shockingly expensive apartment, struggling really hard to come out with living. Our total income would usually run about $200 a month. And I started, like I needed another job, I started writing little articles for the magazines they gave away with diapers. I'd gotten a bunch of them when somebody gave us some diaper service, and they looked like something I could do. So I have a little file somewhere of childcare articles I wrote. Total hokum, most of them, because I didn't know zip, but I was able to put a humorous slant on them and do some stuff. And I usually got $60-$75 for them, which was a huge sum. And it was... And I wrote under the name of Jane Roe because I was working then for a PhD in British history, and I didn't want to be doing scholarly papers under the same name I'd written these pablum articles under. So I adopted the name of Jane Roe, which was part of my original name. I was christened Jane Roe Brewer, Roe being my mother's maiden name and the name of my beloved grandfather. So anyway, there we were, and struggling along. And then Lloyd had some kind of respiratory thing, and they gave him one of these new antibiotics on the market, and he just couldn't get better. It's like it kept popping up all over, and then his heart kicked in, and he had a terrible time, and he was very, very ill. And finally, his physician said, "You have got to just stop the world and get off. You have got to go on a very, very limited existence. You got to reduce stress, or you're going to die," because he has severe ongoing tachycardia. And he kept getting these horrible secondary infections. One of them was ludicrous in retrospect. It looked like elephantiasis of the penis. He got great big blisters all over his penis. And our doctor at the time queried him closely about it being some venereal disease, and Lloyd was so mad at him, he quit him as a doctor. He was furious. But really looked funny. And it was very painful, and he was very unhappy about the situation. And then ultimately the doctor said, the new doctor said, with this level of tachycardia, you are going to die. You're going to have a heart attack, and you won't have any resistance to it. So you need to quit work. You need to stop everything as best you can. And it was in August, and we had children by then of 1 and 3, and I had to find a full-time job that would take care of all of us. My qualifications were a year or two of graduate school beyond my master's in British history, a lot of rather low professional level work in the card catalog, but I had been encouraged by my boss at the university to take some courses in library school. So I had most of a library master's, too, because I'd just taken one course at a time. And I liked it. I had a good time in library school. I found I had a natural flair for it, and I liked the people, and I very much liked the professors. And it was a crummy little school in a house on Sterling Court. And we had to wait in line to get into the reference room in the basement because the fire department would only let 7 of us in at a time. So you had to study upstairs and work your way down the stairs until you were 1 of the 7. It was not a big establishment. It was a pretty interesting thing to interject into my already hectic life. But anyway, I went to my boss at the university library, explained my dilemma, and said I needed a full-time job. And she said, "How's your Hebrew?" And I gasped and said, "A little rusty." And I'm thinking, is that the one you start at the bottom of the page, or you start on the right-hand side and read across, and the letters look funny? And I didn't have a clue about Hebrew, but I thought, if I have to learn Hebrew in 2 weeks, by God, I'll do it. And then I thought of Peg Moss, the wonderful lesbian woman who lived at Botts's house, and called Peg, and she said, "Oh, my God, you're descended from heaven. One of my librarians just quit. 2 weeks from now, school opens, and I've got 2 schools empty." She covered 2 schools, and I'll get you temporary certification. She says, "I'll take your library school professor out to lunch and ply her with drink, and I know she'll qualify you," and it worked. She did. Peg was a dynamo. And the next thing I knew, I had a temporary but fine job as a school librarian out on the Far East. It was part of Madison I'd never even seen, forget been to. One was a little rural school that had been incorporated into the Madison system called Sunnyside, and it looked out on what is now Easttown, but then was cornfields. Mm-hmm. And the kids who went there were children of enlisted men who lived at Truax, the barracks that became Truax housing now. Wonderful kids. They would have gone to school in Turkey the year before, or Germany, and they were interested in a lot of things. They weren't real academic, but they were curious and fun to work with. And my other school was Hawthorne School, which was a very humble but very aspiring lower middle class, upper working class sort of neighborhood, where typically the parents might have an encyclopedia in the house, but no other books, and they would want their kids to do well, and they were very, very supportive. My library, however, the school was very crowded, and my library was in an old speech therapy room, and I think it was maybe 8x10 or 10x12, and I had to carry the books for every class. I'll never forget that I had 8 classes on Thursdays, and I would have to dump a book truck. I didn't have time to reshelve the books and load it up for the next class. I might have a 6th grade and then a kindergarten and then a 2nd grade, and each time I spent the end of the day putting the whole library back together because I dumped everything on the floor. And when I started teaching the card catalog in 4th grade, I had to load it on a book truck and carry the card catalog from room to room. There were 3 4th grade. It was very interesting. It was hectic, and I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. I was good at it. And I wasn't totally aware of it at the time, but it redirected my life. I realized ultimately that if I continued in British history and got my PhD as anticipated, I had most of my coursework in, maybe all of it by then, and was, you know, the prelims would have been the next stage, all the tests. I realized that at best, with the situation of women in history departments, I would be teaching in some little religious school in Iowa for the rest of my life, and Lloyd would be in some comparable situation out there, and it just was not going to be a good thing. And here I was in Madison, which I loved, and found the work that I just loved. It involved developmental stuff with children, and I didn't have any knowledge of kid lit. I'd never even taken a course, but I was so fascinated by the kids, and it was good. I was really, really good. I don't know how, because I was so ignorant, but I think because I loved it so much. And hard as the work was, I just loved it. Home was not fun. I remember getting home and having to take a deep breath because Lloyd, who was really very tired and not feeling well, was taking care of the kids. And he would invariably greet me lethargically, and the kids would both be in dirty diapers. No, I think maybe Jacques was toilet trained by then, but they would be hungry and crabby and needy, and I had to deal with them and get supper, and I'd already done an exhausting day and was ready to be done, and I had another whole job that went into the evening. And it was very, very difficult, and it placed enormous strain on our marriage. And it was like a separate life, because all day I was excited and efficient and enjoying it. And I get home. I did enjoy the children, but they were also, it was also just very difficult because it wasn't anybody's best time of day. And weekends were hectic because we had to play so much catch up. And I still had this thing about being a traditional housewife. I mean, every time we moved to a new apartment, I sewed new drapes, for God's sake, and curtains, and I don't even like drapes and curtains, and I hate to sew, but I did those things because that's what women did. It was still that traditional role, and that year was just, on the domestic scene, was really living hell. But something else came into our life in there somewhere, which was another English person, a just delightful and eccentric young woman moved in upstairs, and didn't have a telephone and would borrow our telephone. And her name was Jocelyn, and she was to become a lifelong friend. She's still one of my very dearest friends. We visit back and forth from England a lot. And Jocelyn would come down to our apartment with her bathrobe wrapped around her and eggs spilled on the front. She was very messy and asked to use the phone, and her hair, which was dyed bright red, would be hanging down over her face. And then we'd stand in the doorway because it was so entertaining. What she'd be doing was calling a cab because she was late to her 8 o'clock class. And a cab would pull up, and she always got the same driver because he enjoyed this thing. And she would be carrying, she would have some kind of shift on her, and her hair still all over and all. And on her way up to Bascom Hill, she would put on her stockings, her underwear, and everything, and put on her makeup and fix her hair. And of course the cab driver was watching the whole process through his rearview mirror and having a terribly good time. But she made it, and she was a great success in the speech department because she was so colorful and she was bright. And but she had a learning disability and couldn't write, really. So I ended up typing, editing, and virtually writing her master's thesis, also as a sort of a part-time job. And I was very attracted to this woman, very, very attracted. And I sort of acknowledged those feelings. She loved me, but not in any physical way, but I would have been very happy to have been physical with Jocelyn. Meanwhile, another mutual friend who was a friend of Jocelyn's, also in the speech department, a friend of Murray's, a colleague of Lloyd's, who was by then starting on a PhD in English and speech and theater, emerged on our scene and sort of joined the extended family. She was a recovering stutterer who was in speech pathology, very, very bright woman with a terrible, terrible family history. I remember that her mother used to burn her with cigarettes as punishment. She had scars from that. And she had become a total stutterer, couldn't speak at all in high school. Had a lovely singing voice, she could sing. But anyway, Maggie came into my life, and oh boy, that was it. I was just head over heels in love with Maggie. And she had been involved in a long-term relationship with another woman in the speech department who was unfortunately a kleptomaniac and kind of scary, and Maggie backed off from her and fell for me. And spring break from school that year was a week of torrid lesbian sex. I told Lloyd I had to have a vacation from him. We borrowed my brother's apartment because he was gone for vacation, and we spent the whole week in bed, and it was great. And if you remember your first lesbian affair, it was like, oh, this is the way it's supposed to be. This is how I should have felt, but certainly did not on my honeymoon or sexual encounters with Lloyd anytime. Sometimes they were fun, but it was just a big nothing compared to this. This was the real thing. I wanted to stand on top of the Capitol and shout to the world, I love this woman. And it was real difficult to reconcile that with what was going on in my life. There just wasn't time, there just wasn't energy. And Maggie was very wary. She was not comfortable with an affair with a married woman, and especially a married woman with children, because she felt that children were just, I think she felt they were sacred. She was so intense about children not having the kinds of experiences she had had as a child. And I remember her looking at Michelle, or listening to Michelle one day and saying, oh, you know, Jane, we could make a stutterer out of that child in 2 weeks. And I bet we could have, too, just because of the way Shelley was a visual person, and words were in back, and they were sacred to her, too, and she would just articulate every word carefully. And it was just, and we both just adored her. Everybody did. Everybody adored Michelle. She was the cutest little urchin. And so it's like separate lives. I had this intense job. I had this intense love affair going. I had this intense friendship with Jocelyn. I was intensely a mother. And Lloyd was an also-ran. And he and I was writing these articles and having fun with it and making a little money. And so he took up a sort of separate life, mostly with men, separate sex life anyway. And going to school, and ultimately it was just was blowing up. We were drinking more and more and more. He got so drunk one night he took an enormous glass ashtray in our living room and threw it through the front window, which was real heavy glass, and at one point we had a physical encounter. He was no more to blame for it than I was. He just had longer arms, so he was more successful. And I remember going to school with two black eyes and all kinds of bruises and explaining that I'd fallen down the stairs over two tricycles, and they knew I had little kids, so everybody accepted that. I was lame, and I mean, it was really bad. It was a drunken brawl is what it was. And he won. And it, you know, I was mad because I would like to knock him flat. I just detested him at that moment, drunk. And every time we got drunk, we got very, very hostile, very, very hostile. We'd start out all right, and then boom, very hostile. And so all this nice, easy bisexual acceptance and all this stuff would just go up in smoke. We were, something was going wrong. The only thing we had really was each of us our academic ambitions and each of us a passionate love of our children. And we came very, very close to splitting right then, but we just could not resolve what would happen with the children. It just didn't feel good to us. And somehow, in the middle of it all, I got pregnant with a third child, and that corked it. We moved. The only place we could find to live was a farm that they were going to, where the house was just waiting to be torn down out in Middleton. And we could have that for a year, and Lloyd could finish his degree, and I could go back to library school and finish it with great difficulties. I commuted by moped from Middleton. Chris was born in March, and it was a nightmare. He turned out to be a 10.5-pound baby, came 2 weeks late. He's been late to everything ever since. We had horrible snows that year, and we lived about a third of a mile in from the road, and I was sure that I'd have to have the baby in the farmhouse, and that would not be good because Lloyd fainted in the natural childbirth course I'd taken when I was pregnant with Jacques. When they showed the movie of an actual birth, they had to spend the whole time reviving him because he went out flat on the floor. And I just couldn't picture him delivering a baby. So that was not a fun pregnancy. But I managed not to drink through it, which was good. At one point, I went to a psychiatrist, and this was before Chris was, I was pregnant with Chris, and said, I'm worried about my drinking. I think it's really getting to be a problem. And she said, well, how are you eating? And I said, great, I love food, you know, and I'm getting to be a pretty good cook, and I enjoy it. Well, she said, well, you're all right then. That was my big psychiatric intervention. And I wasn't, of course, I was a periodic alcoholic, but I was able to quit for each of my pregnancies, which was good. But boy, about 10 minutes after Chris was born, I was back drinking a lot. I would come home from library school, stop at the liquor store, pick up a couple of fifths, and they would rattle in my, we didn't have very good panniers in those days on the moped, and I remember the liquor bottles rattling. And I would do whatever I needed to do with Chris. I had an afternoon babysitter, and Chris and I would be out on a blanket, and Jack and Michelle would be playing in, around the barn, and we had a barn, and the landlord's daughter kept a couple horses in it. And I would get really, really drunk, and that happened almost every night. And then I could face Lloyd coming home from whatever he was doing, which was going to graduate school, but we didn't even travel together. He wouldn't let me use the car. I had to do this moped thing. It was just, I don't know how I ever let him get away with it. He didn't like it that I was finishing library school because he knew it could make me independent. I could have a job. And it was very difficult. And that whole year living in that farmhouse, I was pining for Maggie, who had declared she just couldn't do this, and writing her a long tedious letters and getting much terser responses and wishing I were living with her and somehow with all the kids too because she'd be such a good mother too and blah blah. It was really kind of ridiculous, but it was very passionate feeling. And I'd been missing that in my life. I really needed the intimacy and I think the passion. And so it was also very exciting, although difficult.